Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Money and Markets. This is Catherine Austin Fitz and John Titus. We're recording on June 14th for publication on Thursday, June 15th. We have many stories to cover today. John, what's our theme?
What is the price for killing the truth?
A lot of people are spending a lot of money to kill the truth these days.
They sure are.
The price is going up. Or maybe I should say the price is right. So let's dive in.
Okay. Let's go right to bank crisis, the crisis watch, and begin with a story that really that's kind of old news for Solari subscribers. This is from Bloomberg. I thought it was from Bloomberg. Yeah, Bloomberg Business Week. A $1.5 trillion backstop for homebuyers props up banks instead. And they're talking about the Federal Home Loan Bank System, which we've talked about several times. And they finally come around to telling you what I told you in a video two videos ago, back in February, about the FHLB and panic borrowing. And now Bloomberg says, 4 months later, the first sign of deep trouble in U.S. banking system this year came from a sun-baked office complex in a San Diego suburb. A small firm called Silvergate assured investors it was weathering a run on deposits. Its lifeline was $4.3 billion from a Federal Home Loan Bank. Silvergate didn't have a network of branches serving consumers, and it barely offered mortgages. It specialized in moving dollars for cryptocurrency ventures. Soon it became apparent that a roster of troubled regional banks was leaning on FHLB, a relic of the Great Depression, originally aimed at ensuring financial firms have cash to lend to homebuyers. Yet the banks had little to do with everyday mortgage lending. Silicon Valley Bank, catering to venture capitalists and tech startups, said it held $15 billion at an FHLB at the end of 2022. Okay, but they bury the lead here, which is here's what you really want to know out of this story. Come on, get to it. Okay. FHLBs continued to swell as banks sought financing, especially in emergencies. The system's total loans to members surged 28% to $1.04 trillion in this year's first 3 months, beating a record set in the third quarter of 2008. So that right there tells you a couple things. One, that's a lot of scratch, over $1 trillion. And two, this crisis is not over, right? They're still borrowing away. The borrowing is still going up at the FHLB. This crisis, we're not done.
So it's really interesting. Their statutory authority was redone in 89 by FIREA. So that financial crisis saw their authorities changed, presumably sort of stretched. And then again in 2008, during the financial crisis, again stretched. So these are government-sponsored enterprises. They're regulated together with Freddie and Fannie. And I looked up their authorities after we talked about the story and realized that technically they're supposed to support home lending and community development. And one of the things I'm wondering is if all the smart grid activities, you know, and crypto is deemed to be community development. So somebody's driving a truck through the scope here. So
yeah. I talk a lot about FHLBs. I put it on the radar in a video I did two videos ago. It's called Why is the Federal Reserve Provoking a Financial Crisis? And, you know, I just kind of go into what the FHLB system is. It's sort of like it's a junior varsity version of the Federal Reserve.
Right. But if you're the Federal Reserve and you want to keep certain kinds of emergency lending off balance sheet, this is a perfect way to do it, right?
Certainly off your balance sheet.
Right. It's off your balance sheet.
In fact, that point you just raised gets right into our next story. You just saw that lending was $1 trillion at the FHLBs.
Right.
Okay. And it was buried in that Bloomberg story. It was 20 some odd paragraphs down.
Right.
Now let's go to Barron's and see what they're focusing your attention on. Okay. Here we go. Banks emergency lending from the Fed tops $100 billion. So it's right out of the gate. It's a tenth as much.
Right.
They're like, looky here. The banks are emergency lending is $100 billion. Borrowing from the Federal Reserve's bailout program is creeping up with the latest numbers hitting a new high. The statement published late afternoon Thursday showed that $100 billion was borrowed under the Bank Term Funding Program in the week through Wednesday higher than the $94 billion borrowed in the prior week. So they're like, looky here, they're borrowing, you know, and you think, well, $100 billion is not that much. You're right. $1 trillion is quite a bit more, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So they've kept a lot off of their, you know, so the Fed is not providing the liquidity. They're having the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. Now, I saw very strange patterns between HUD and the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. You know, they would use the Federal Home Loan Bank Board for some of their bank accounts and depository. And, you know, I never thought about it then until I started to see what's been going on. And I'm looking back and thinking, I wonder what was going on there. Because you had a lot of funny business going on in the HUD accounts. And it would have been easier to do it through the Federal Home Loan Bank Board than through the New York Fed.
Well, you're not going to get any transparency, any more transparency from the FHLB than you are from the Fed. Because those 11 banks, it's a regional system like the Fed, but there's 11 rather than 12. And all 11 are private entities.
Right. Exactly.
So good luck with your FOIA request. You're going to get denied.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's turn to the last story in really Crisis Watch. This story could just as well go in Fed Watch. This is about interest rates. And I don't really know what's going on here. U.S. interest rate swap market embraces new rate as LIBOR deadline nears. And this is just stories about the switch over away from LIBOR. New trades in the enormous U.S. dollar interest rate swap market have almost entirely stopped using the London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR, as the deadline for its demise approaches. A record 91% of new dollar swaps executed in May used the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, SOFR, the newly accepted U.S. benchmark, as their reference rate. And here I'll just show you on the Fred graph. Let me blow that up. Yeah, there's the rate. So, but in fact, if you try to go into this and look at and say, well, can I compare that to LIBOR? There's no overlap between the two at all.
Right. Well, you know, I have several times tried to understand why they decided to switch it, and number one, and why anyone would think switching it, other than being logistically complicated and taking time, why it would be a nightmare. Now, if you look at the people who have the power to delay this, if they run into real trouble, they have the power to delay. They've done it before. And they're leaving a synthetic rate out for existing, you know, paper and vehicles that use LIBOR. They say they're going to end that at September 2024. And here is the thing, John. You do have existing legal contractual documents and trusts and pools of money that depend on that rate. If it goes away and they legally have to be redone, you got a real mess. But they have the power to delay or leave that synthetic rate out until, you know, nothing else is existing with LIBOR. So, you know, why this? Occasionally we'll see different people predict the end of the world because of this, and it's completely ludicrous and ridiculous. It's a complicated thing to do, but the guys who are running it can delay or control or do whatever they want. It shouldn't be a problem. What it does do is it gives the big institutions a big advantage over a lot of little guys.
That I don't understand.
Because they have the resources to deal with the complexity and attend to the function, whereas, you know, it can be a big job for the smaller firms. It's all, you know, these are traditionally tricks that are done to facilitate centralization. That doesn't mean that's why it happened. I still can't come up with a good reason on why they did it.
I can't either. Right. And what makes me suspicious is I go onto the Fred website, the St. Louis Federal Reserve database, which maintains 822,000 different series. I type in LIBOR, L-I-B-O-R, and they bring up three series, not like 3,000, but three, like 1, 2, 3. It's like, I know you maintain more than three data series on LIBOR, the most important interest rate in the world. Yeah, right. I mean, in other words, you'd have the 30-day, you'd have the year, you'd have the 60, you know, three. You've got rid of a lot. What are you hiding?
One of the hardest things the central bankers are doing is managing the interest rate swap book as they take interest rates up. That is one of the hardest things they're doing. You know, in theory, this may give them more ability to invasively intercede. I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway, that's it for LIBOR. Let's turn to FedWatch and the first story. This is the first of two stories this week called the John Wants to Shoot Himself in the Face story because it's so much, there's so much pressle talk. I just, like, what is the point of this? I mean, this is ridiculous. Financial, this is from, they're both, these, both of the stories, I want to shoot myself in the face stories, come from like the Luminary publication class, right?
Right.
Starting with the Financial Times. Okay. U.S. The headline, U.S. Treasury's $1 trillion borrowing drive set to put banks under strain. Okay, great. Why are banks going to be under strain? Because of borrowing. A $1 trillion U.S. government borrowing spree is set to increase the strain on the country's banking system as Washington returns to the markets in the aftermath of the debt ceiling fight, traders and analysts say. Well, did it cause a strain in previous debt ceiling problems? No, we don't know. A principal concern voiced by analysts was that the sheer volume of new issuance would push up yields on government debt, sucking cash out of bank deposits. Okay, I understand. In other words, rates go up, and so now people, they write a check to from their bank account into the U.S. Treasury, one of my treasuries, right?
Well, the big way they do it is they move money to money market accounts, you know, either at the bank or in the brokerage account. But remember, the banks can put money in their investment portfolio. And one of the games that happens is their deposits go up by some magical means. And they put it, so you and I looked at deposits yesterday. You know, the bank's investment in treasuries is going up. So there are a couple of vehicles for them to switch the money that lower deposits, but there are others that raise deposits and have it working through the balance sheet of the big banks.
The point is there are two ways to get money out of the banking system, okay? One way is people pay back their loans.
Right.
The principal payments knock down the money supply, okay? The second way is just what you said, which is whoever spends money at the Treasury, because the Treasury's operational account is at the Fed.
Right.
But when you write a $100 check to the Treasury for bonds, $100 goes out of the banking system.
Right. But most of those bonds are not getting bought in the primary market direct to Treasury.
That does not matter.
Yes, I agree.
It does not matter who writes the check.
Right.
It doesn't matter if it goes to the money market or individually, that money is going out if you write it to the Treasury.
Right.
By way of that background, let's now look at, they're saying this is a strain on the banking system. Well, when somebody writes a check, let's say a $100 check to the Treasury, that's a $100 liability leaving the bank, right? So the bank is going to have to cough up an asset to match that liability. And that asset they're going to cough up is called reserves. They have deposit accounts at the Fed. And that $100 deposit that they get to erase from their balance sheet, they're also going to have to erase an asset. And the asset they're going to erase in parallel is called their deposit account. Here's the graph of their deposit accounts. Look at this. The deposit accounts are sitting at $3.3 trillion, right? Look at me to show you this graph. See this?
Right.
Their deposit account, $3.3 trillion the banks have right now. There's no strain whatsoever. None. They have an amount of cash from here to Pluto they're sitting on. Anyway, let's go back to this story in the Financial Times, because that has superficial plausibility. But when you go beneath the surface, it's like, no, that story doesn't work. Sorry. So let's go on. Further deposit flight and the rise in yields could in turn push banks to offer higher interest rates on savings accounts, which could be particularly costly for smaller lenders. Okay, so now I see you're back to pushing small banks are in trouble theme, which we know isn't true. At present, roughly $2.2 trillion a night is being put into the Fed's overnight reverse repurchase agreement facility, much of it from money market funds. But then they get to the punchline and they said, well, if investors expect the Fed to continue to tighten monetary policy, they're likely to keep their cash parked with the central bank overnight rather than buying bills. So there's no stress at all. You know, it's just like, well, that story answered nothing.
The story is incoherent. I can't make sense out of it.
Right. It's totally incoherent.
Right.
That's incoherent story number one for the week. But there
is a backup of borrowing, and the Treasury is going to be in the market, whether the Fed's monetizing it or they're selling it. between now and the end of the year, and certainly for the next 4 months. And everybody wants to know what impact is that going to have.
And you know what I think that story is?
But
it's not, it's misinformation. Reason they give for bank strain is not true. They're warning you that the crisis is not over. They're saying, don't be surprised, banks are under strain. Not for the reasons we're telling you, they're under strain.
Right. Right. And one of the reasons they're under strain is the New York Fed and the big banks are trying to steal the U.S. banking system.
Yeah, right.
And they got hedge funds and short sellers on their side, and they're pushing rumors. And Right.
You're not going to read that story, though, in the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
You got to come here.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, let's keep it going, FedWatch. This next story, it started out as a chart. The charts, though, they're kind of not helpful. I'll come back to the charts. Let's skip down to the text. It's kind of interesting. They have a table here of asset type here and then returns here. And the biggest, the heaviest return you get is from U.S. equities.
Yep.
9.8%. And they offer a 10-year annualized return of 11.9%. Okay. So why are U.S. equities so good? This is interesting. U.S. equities have rebounded the fastest in 2023, 9.8%, as we just saw. This has largely been a story of a few outperformers buoying the overall market. NVIDIA with 159%, Meta 120%, Apple 36%, Microsoft 37% are among the companies with strong growth. Many of these companies are investing billions in artificial intelligence. And that's really the story there.
Right. I would say they're investing billions in the smart grid and control. So to me, it's a story. There are 5 to 10 stocks that are carrying the market, and they're all about central control. And almost everything else in the market is going sideways or down. It's extraordinary. So there's a real division happening.
Yeah. There's a real division happening. Yeah. But the rest of they have charts for the other years. I'll show you this real quick. So you can see, now I can't make it heads or tails of this chart. Let's go on to a more interesting story, which is Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Epstein accuser. This is from NPR. The other stories just didn't come out right. Meaning they didn't show up on the screen right. There was like pop-up ads and weird stuff. Okay. Epstein accuser Jane Doe 1 reaches $290 million settlement with J.P. Morgan Chase. Very curious story. Jane Doe 1, a survivor of Epstein's sex crimes, who accused J.P. Morgan of facilitating disgraced billionaire's abuse of dozens of girls and young women, has reached a settlement with the bank on behalf of herself and other victims. The bank will pay $200 million as part of the settlement, according to David Boies. Okay, Boies is like a kind of go-to guy who, in the play of Cowboys versus Indian, he always represents the bad guys. He's always representing the bad guys, and he's guaranteed to say nothing very threatening.
Okay, right.
He's going to give you the most anodyne explanation for stuff in the world, and
he was the hitman lawyer for Theranos.
Yes,
and if I remember the original Jane Doe case, I read that he was representing, was also accusing Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boies was also represented AIG in its trial against the Federal Reserve. Right. He's a go-to character.
Right.
Like Alan Dershowitz, he's one of these guys that can be counted on to not you know, rock the boat. And we're going to have to take a pause here because Braves has decided it wants to take a vacation while it refreshes. Hopefully everybody else isn't doing the same thing. But this story on J.P. Morgan Chase and Epstein is interesting because they go over some of the lawsuit. And there's a part of the lawsuit that I didn't know about. And I'm like, oh, do tell. And they don't tell. But I got to wait until.
Well, here's the thing. Our theme is what's the price for killing the truth?
Yeah.
And clearly one price this week is $290 million for J.P. Morgan Chase to.
Right.
Now,
right.
Remember, Whitney Webb's been doing a series. She's done 2 of 3, a story of Jamie Dimon and Epstein. So there's real sensitivity here.
Yeah. Okay, well, Brave is, we're going to have to come back to Brave because it's ridiculous. I'm getting, you know, if I could find a browser that would work somewhere, that'd be great. But I
so
can't.
We there's use not, Firefox not... and Safari. We won't touch
Firefox
Brave.
Here's Firefox's problem.
Okay? What?
If I leave it up a certain amount of time, the text on certain stories turns into acrylic.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just out of the blue. It's like, okay, well, that one's out.
Okay.
Yeah, we can't read it. I'm going to go to the money shot here. The settlement, Monday settlement. This is the paragraph we want to look at here next to. Monday settlement was reached 1 month after Judge Jed Rakoff in the Southern District of New York dismissed some of Jane Doe 1's claims against the bank, leaving four other far-reaching claims intact. Okay. Not only did those four claims accuse J.P. Morgan of negligence, they also alleged that the bank knowingly benefited from participating in a sex trafficking venture and obstructed enforcement of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. That is a very, very, that's a criminal charge. That's not a civil case.
That's a criminal charge, and it's a PR problem of great magnitude.
That's a huge problem. The thrust of the story, the worst parts of the story are basically, you knew about Jeffrey Epstein so long, and it was so intricately involved that you guys were really partners in the sex ring,
right.
J.P. Morgan.
Right.
You. It wasn't that you didn't know about him. You were a partner with him
right.
in it. That's basically the thrust of the story.
Right.
But the,
he
the
couldn't have operated the way he did without them facilitating it.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
He couldn't. Right. But the obstruction charge, that's new to me. It's like the obstruction.
That is a criminal charge.
Wow.
Now, this is a civil litigation. If you're guilty of obstruction in a civil litigation, there's still no criminal prosecution involved.
No, right. It's civil litigation. It's,
right.
it's either money or an injunction or some equitable remedy like that. But the fact is, like, well, if you didn't know about it, why are you blocking people from looking into
well,
it?
Well, here's the thing. The Virgin Islands lawsuit is open at the same time. If Epstein is found guilty of obstruction in a civil case, while the Virgin Island case is going on, could it bleed over? Could it impact it?
No, it's not law of the case,
right?
It's not even really stare decisis. But you know, cases are funny things. It's not until they're finally resolved that you get any sort of legal effect in a parallel case. However, it's admissions that can be used in your case.
Right. It's disclosure that can be used in the other case.
You're damn right it can.
Right.
Because
it's still in the first leg. So in theory, it could come over.
Admissions come in. I mean, it's out-of-court statements. Because
I'd pay $290 million. You know, if I made more than $30 billion a year, I'd pay $290 million to get rid of this. Wouldn't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. J.P. Morgan Chase, I mean, I'll remind people that it has $3.2 trillion in assets, trillion with a T.
Right.
Okay, $290 million. That's two rungs down.
Right.
Okay. You're going from trillion to billion to million.
Right.
Right. So it's
right. Their danger, though, is it's a neon sign to the other victims that they're open to for settlement.
Yeah, it's a neon sign to the public too.
Right.
That this is a serious criminal enterprise.
They've been giving those signals, you know, quarterly for two decades.
They have, but young girls.
Yep.
We're not talking about a breach of know your customer rules or anti-money laundering. That's really serious.
We're talking about institutionalized sex trafficking as a business, intentionally.
When I try to tell normal people about financial crimes, their eyes glaze over. You tell them about a sex ring, now they're listening.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay, let's turn to another story. This next one is really interesting to me. I used to play the horses, but this looks like a beta test to me. Why are all these racehorses dropping dead at Churchill Downs? Churchill Downs, of course, is where the Kentucky Derby is. It's a major track. Why are they dropping dead? Because since April 29, they've all been wearing powerful wireless monitors called StrideSafe. Okay? The spring meet this year at the Downs, at Churchill Downs, began on April 29. It was to continue until July 3rd. And that day, April 29, in every race on every day thereafter, every horse was fitted with a device they had never worn before, shaped like an iPhone, this device. And there they show it. This stride-safe device monitors the horse's movements 2,400 times per second throughout the race, sending 2,400 pulses of radio frequency radiation every second through the body of the horse. Horses racing at Churchill Downs began to die during races or suffer such severe injuries they were euthanized. So many horses have died this spring that on June 2nd, okay, it was announced that the spring meet would be suspended June 10th. So they're going to cut the season short, right? They're supposed to go to July 3rd. They're now moving up a month, basically. That's a huge thing when your meet's only 3 months long. Officials have carefully inspected the track and every part of the racing grounds and have found no change in any part of it from previous meets. But they have the same blind spot as the rest of society. They treat wireless devices and the radiation they emit as if they do not exist. And so this guy goes on, he says, we have known for decades that horses' lives are shattered by radio waves. And he quotes an older story from a couple decades back. He says, here's the part that gets me. He says, I send an email to Dr. Jennifer Durenberger suggesting to her, she's like the vet at Churchill Downs, suggesting to her that stride-safe devices, which have been deployed at Churchill Downs for the safety of the horses, are instead killing them. So it's really stride-safe, which you're saying is safe for the horses, it's killing them. What about the radiation? She has not yet responded.
Right. So there, this is not the first time this happened. It happened at Santa Anita a couple years ago where you had this pattern of death, and the question was what was causing it. And
yeah.
What is astonishing to me, John, because I have a theory that I have great confidence in. There is no doubt if you're running the track and you're running the betting pool on the track, not just the betting pool at the track, but the off-track betting, and you have the ability to slow down or drop a horse, that's very valuable. So my concern is that there's real, it's not just surveillance of what the horses are doing during the race. It can really impact their performance.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this, though. The betting pools, and it's all one pool. There's not separate pools at OTBs. They all pool together electronically. The betting pools aren't that big. They're not that big.
Even offshore?
No.
No?
They're all in the same. I think they're all in the same pool, but they're not that big. But I'll tell you how I know. I used to be really into horse racing.
Right.
And I went to, I think it was the Virginia Derby in 2009. And the betting, and I won two dime supers. I won two superfectas.
Right.
And the betting pools were so thin, they didn't pay out that much. They paid out like $200, which
right.
I had good. I was like, come on.
Right.
And I realized the betting pools had gotten really thin due to the financial crisis.
Ah. So why else would anybody require that the horses carry this? Is it just to do the coverage and the coverage of the race?
If you wanted to test out a device that you might want to use on humans later.
Right. Something? I take it back. That's a very good reason.
Horses would be a good start.
Right.
Then kill a horse, kill a human.
Right. I can't imagine a positive reason to require these.
I don't either.
But here's the thing. If you were going to, if this was killing the horses, why would you stop the season? Why wouldn't you just cancel the stride safe?
Because you've been instructed not to cancel stride safe.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't come up with any theory that's cheerful on this.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not good. The death, killing animals like horses. I mean, those animals, those horses.
Those are beautiful animals. I
mean, they're insane as hell. I mean, for sure. But they are beautiful animals.
Right.
And this is just it's not good. What's going on?
Right.
Grim. Super grim.
It is very grim.
There's some evil. Big time, and it's spilling over into broad daylight now.
Right.
Anyway. Okay. Let's another sports story on money markets. Okay. This is a happy one. This is a recurring character. Djokovic wins 23rd crown by conquering Rude at French Open. And the significance here is he has now he's got a record 23rd Grand Slam singles title at the French Open. There's four different races. There's Australian Open, French Open, Wimbledon, and U.S. Open. They're part of the Grand Slam. He's now won 23 of them, which is, I think that puts him alone as a man. The 36-year-old Serbian drew level with Nadal on number 22 by bagging the Australia Open crown in January. So he moves into a tie with the men's, but now he's outright in the lead with 23. And he says, obviously a Grand Slam is a Grand Slam, said Djokovic, who moved level with women's great Serena Williams on 23 major titles and sits one behind Margaret Court, who has 24. We actually have a chart on this here. There you go, well, 23 and counting.
They don't have Court. If Court had 24, how come she's not here?
Yeah, I don't know why. Let's see. Yeah, they don't have Court. I don't know why she's not there. Status to fell down on the job.
Court may be. They have since 1968 in the Open era. So Court was prior to the Open era is what it is.
Could be. I was going to say it might be she was unvaccinated, but so is he. You know. And
touché.
So is Court.
Touche. So right. Court. You know. Court. Yeah.
Certainly unvaccinated if she's not in the right era. Okay. Let's go to the next story. This one made me laugh. This is another good one. Antarctica sensation. Ice shelves surrounding the continent grew going in the wrong direction. I thought there was global warming. There's just a shrink in overall size in 2009. No, they're growing. The ice shelves surrounding Antarctica grew in overall size during the 11 years to 2019, according to dramatic new evidence published by three climate scientists from the University of Leeds. The growth was significant, with overall shelf area increasing by 5,300 square kilometers, adding 0.4% to the total shelf area in the 11 years under review. The paper has just been published by the influential European Geosciences Union, but it raises questions within the settled climate science narrative, so it is highly unlikely to be covered by mainstream media. Yeah, no kidding.
Well, I will say this. The glaciers in Switzerland are shrinking from everything just sitting in the cafes and watching them. And it's a matter of great grief to the people in Switzerland. They're very focused on their glaciers.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway, so, you know, what do you do? It's another case for the settled science. Turns out to be not so reliable.
Well, if you look at all the stuff that WHO's working on, they're clearly getting ready to, you know, to manipulate and use phony baloney climate science. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's turn attention to war in Ukraine. We've been hearing a lot about the much-touted Ukrainian counteroffensive. Things are not going well. I mean, I don't know if you've kept up with videos, but there's all sorts of Russian videos out there trolling Americans, taking over, you know, German tanks, American-made tanks, taking while they're still running. I mean, it's just been...
The coverage. So The Economist has coverage on the Ukraine offensive. It's front page Economist. And there's page after page of detailed description of the successful battles and surges. And you read it and you think, this is all fiction. The whole thing is just fiction.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Anyway, so I was very interested to see this one from VoltaireNet.
Well, VoltaireNet's one, but the real tell is the next one. But let's take them in order. VoltaireNet, Ukrainian army crushed. No ambiguity there. In 6 days, the Western weapons amassed by the Ukrainian army were virtually all destroyed. Ammo, tanks, and aircraft. The human toll exacted by Ukraine's catastrophic counteroffensive is beyond counting. The Ukrainian army crumbled along the first line of Russian defense. It could not make it to the second, despite seven successive waves of attack to penetrate them, the last one being on the night of June 9th and 10th. So it's all but over right there. It just didn't, and that's consistent with every other report,
really?
On the ground report. I mean, the videos you see on Telegram, it's just not, it's not good. The Russians are basically laughing at this whole thing.
So my only question is, I don't see how the Ukraine can field a real army how much of that army that led those seven offensives was mercenary?
Well, we saw a couple weeks ago that, you know, Americans are now appearing dead in the battles.
Right.
Remember, the American guy goes over there and takes a look around and he stumbles on. There was a Russian and he stumbles on this American who went over there.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, they are a big part of the Ukrainian resistance is certainly NATO mercenaries.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But the real way you know things aren't going well is this next story from an official publication. This is story number two of I want to shoot myself in the face. I've died and gone to hell, and I wake up in Princeton graduate studies program for history, and I have to read stuff like this. Foreign affairs, an unwinnable war. Okay. You just got to scroll down, get to the parts. 15 months of fighting has made, so right away, you know that things aren't going well if the foreign affairs is saying it's unwinnable.
So this is the Council for Foreign Relations. And, you know, I don't know if I ever told you this, my reading material when I was 16 to 18, before I graduated from high school, every day I read the New York Times and I had a subscription to Foreign Affairs magazine.
Yeah, I had one to The Economist back when I was in high school, actually.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, because my history teacher was influential, and he was like, yeah, The Economist is where it is. I'm like, okay.
Well, it used to have good material. Economist used to be a lot better.
Right. Yeah. Right. Anyway, back to foreign affairs. So far from winning, the U.S. is not only not winning the war right now, where the Ukraine is not only not winning, the war is unwinnable.
Right.
That's the official line. What's going on? Well, 15 months of, they tried to spin it. 15 months of fighting has made clear that neither side has the capacity, even with external help, to achieve a decisive military victory over the other. Regardless of how much territory Ukrainian forces can liberate, Russia will maintain the capability to pose a permanent threat to Ukraine. So they're trying to cast it like, well, these two rams, their horns are interlocked and you can't extract them from each other. We got to get out. You got to go on, though. Ukraine would be on near total economic and military life support. Here we get a snippet of truth. Ukraine would be on near total economic and military life support from the West, which will eventually cause budgetary challenges for Western countries and readiness problems for their militaries. Okay? So that's what they're telling you. They're warning the U.S., you got some problems here. But then the real, it's just drivel. This goes on and on. And then there's this and there's that. But then you get to this. This is amazing. An entire new U.S. military command element, the Security Assistance Group, Ukraine, has been devoted to the aid and training mission, which is led by a 3-star general with a staff of 300. Okay, this is a totally new group to set to winning. Yet there is not a single official in the U.S. government whose full-time job is conflict diplomacy. Like, are you kidding me? Talk about putting all your eggs in one basket.
So the neocon strategy believes that they can take down Russia. And the way they do that is just by draining them economically over a very long period of time. And what the council is saying and what foreign affairs is saying is we don't have the economic and financial capacity to play that strategy.
Yeah, right.
You know, so this is a budget question.
Yeah, I mean, everybody who thinks they're going to conquer Russia, they end up frozen way out in Siberia. You know, it doesn't work. That's not going to happen, guy.
Well, here's the problem. The commodity producers are walking away from the West and making it much more expensive to play this game. So you didn't have the South go with you. You didn't, you know, you're trying to take on Russia and China without G20 supporting, and you don't have the, you know, you don't have the commodity clout to do it. Unless you really want to bankrupt the G7. I mean, and the neocons may be willing to do it. And the question is, if they get digital financial control, if they destroy financial transaction freedom, can they get the necessary repression to achieve the resource use they need to do this?
That's a very good question.
Right.
That's an interesting, I had never thought of that.
Oh, yeah. But there's a reason why they want financial repression. They want the ability to get total financial control, cut off financial transaction freedom, use financial transactions to give them complete control. That will give them the resources they need to finish playing this game.
Yeah, well, as we'll see in another story, the resources aren't playing along with that, that plan.
Right.
But let's go to our last story, in a war in Ukraine. And this is another way you know it's not going well. From antiwar.com, Sweden will allow NATO deployments in signal to Russia. So they're just moving the playing field. Stockholm plans to send a signal to Russia by allowing NATO troop deployments in Sweden before the country is admitted into the alliance, according to top officials. Turkey is holding up Sweden's bid to join the bloc. Last year, Sweden and Finland broke their longstanding policy of neutrality and formally applied to join NATO. Their bid met stiff opposition from Turkey. Russian officials have said Moscow will respond to NATO expanding its presence in Finland and Sweden. In December, Shoigu said, given NATO's desire to increase its military potential near Russian borders, as well as to expand the alliance by adding Finland and Sweden, it is necessary to take retaliatory measures and to create an appropriate grouping of troops in the northwest of Russia. So don't think you're going to move the border and we're not going to follow you. We are.
Well, here's my question. If you get Sweden and Finland into NATO, and then you do a tactical nuke false flag, and you pull an Article 5, can you get NATO into the war?
NATO better hope not.
But I think there are a lot of people who would do that.
I think there are. I think there are, too. But, you know, that story right there,
right,
that they're moving the board, that completely reveals, that exposes Ukraine for what it is, which is an offensive NATO operation. We tried it in Ukraine. It didn't work. And now we're going to move it. If it's defensive, who cares?
So Putin and Belarus are now talking about moving tactical nukes into Belarus south, right?
Wow.
So.
Yeah.
So the game of chicken is taking a step up. And that's why if Sweden and Finland come in, that's something to watch. When that happens, we're in a new danger zone.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's turn to resources, though, in space military global turf wars. You raise that. You know, you getting control of the money to control the resources.
Right.
And that may not go so well. And this story is about Qatar, Q-A-T-A-R. Some people pronounce it Qatar. I can't bring myself to do that.
Qatar.
So it's Qatar it is, okay? Rhymes with guitar. All right. Qatar seals 27-year LNG deal with China. As competition heats up, natural gas, okay? Qatar Energy has signed a 27-year deal to supply China's Sinopec with liquefied natural gas in the longest such LNG agreement to date, as volatility drives buyers to seek long-term supplies. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February, competition for LNG has become intense, with Europe in particular needing vast amounts to help replace Russian pipeline gas that used to make up almost 95% of imports, of the continent's imports. I think there was one more. No, that's it. So, but that, you talk about making a bet on which way things are going. Qatar's like, well, we're putting our resources there for 27 years.
Right. So one of the things they point out is how important gas is to the long-term energy picture, which is true. But, you know, I don't remember ever seeing a 27-year deal. And I used to be in the energy group at Dillon Reed, so
it was unprecedented.
Right. It's unprecedented, and it's also a clearer signal to Europe. We feel free to go to the east. And when you and I first talked about the Russians moving into the Ukraine and the sanctions, what we said was this was going to engineer significant low-cost energy to Asia. And to me, it looks like a top-down decision to do so.
Yeah. You know, you've got to take a step back and realize that one of the ways the dollar maintained its war reserve currency status after 1971 in breaking the gold standard was to go to the petrodollar.
Right.
It's saying all the contracts have to be done. It was energy-based, right? Now the BRICS nations, the South, is kind of doing the same thing.
Right.
They're sort of amassing resources. You got to wonder how long it's going to be before they come out the currency that's pegged to resources.
So here's the interesting thing. If you look at the reserve currency play, the dollar is still very much dangerous and dominant. And part of it is because it's cannibalized the euro to a certain extent. But if you look at the trade lines and all the swaps, and there is significant greater trade that's going direct currency to currency. So there's much more resiliency since 2008 in the whole currency system. But that is happening very quietly, and it's happening more on the asset side of the balance sheet. So, you know, the dollar is still dangerous and dominant. And countries all around the world need dollars to repay their dollar-based debt. That's the strength in the system. But, you know, there is no doubt that the multipolar world is here and it's rising.
Yeah, no question about that. And they're amassing resources. You know,
right?
They've got the bulk of they're going to win that one.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you can't punch out Russia militarily or China, which is kind of part and parcel. On the one hand, and you can't control the resources. On the other hand, what do you got? What do you got left? So you got a lot of financial instruments. You got a lot of paper. Is the bottom line?
Well, what I can't figure out is why they thought the Russian sanction strategy would work.
They're idiots. They just think that works. We're used to pushing around, little countries, little itty bitty players. We're not, the U.S. is not used to trying to being up against a peer adversary.
Well, but I watched for many years while the competent people got pushed out and the yes men rose. You know, the people who would play politics rose. And I'm just wondering if we've reached a tipping point in terms of incompetency in the middle levels of the U.S. establishment. Not at the top, but in the middle levels.
That's a great question.
Right.
The scary part is the answer might be yes. We have reached a tipping point, and this is what we're seeing now.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just turn to another story. Last story in space military global tour. This isn't really a story. This is ridiculous. Wall Street Journal: Cuba to host secret Chinese spy base focusing on U.S. That's funny. I thought we had Guantanamo base there. So really, China's down there building a separate base. Do tell. All you need to know about this story is right here. On Thursday, after publication of this article, Press Secretary Kirby in the White House said, "This report is not accurate," without providing any details. Yes, I think that pretty much sums it up. Not accurate. am I missing something?
Well, we know they put all of their listening in air balloons, right?
Yeah, I mean, come on, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they need air balloons because their police stations on the ground are not sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's turn to Hey Robot with CBDC, crypto, AI, biometrics, the whole ball of wax.
Yep.
Here we go. Wall Street Journal. SEC sues Coinbase, alleges it is unregistered broker. So the war continues on crypto. SEC sued Coinbase on Tuesday, okay? On Monday, the regulator sued the world's largest crypto exchange, Binance. So Coinbase is the largest in the U.S. Binance is the largest in the world, and the SEC is going after them both in lawsuits, saying you're an exchange and you can't be doing what you're doing. Here we go. Coinbase is one of few publicly traded crypto companies and one of the best known. Its biggest shareholders include Vanguard, Cathie Wood's ARK Investment Management, Fidelity, BlackRock, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs Group, according to FactSet. And the SEC is going after them. What do you make of that?
So I see these two lawsuits as being very different. And I think Coinbase is in a very bad position because basically what they're saying is that a whole series of the tokens they're trading should have been registered as securities. And because they're securities, now those tokens don't think they are securities. So those 12 are being debated. They're not saying Ether or Bitcoin, which are the big ones, right? But they're saying those 12. And then they're saying, because you're trading securities, you need to register as an exchange. Now, how do you register as a securities exchange when, in fact, the tokens themselves say they're not securities? And how do you apply securities regulation when the tokens themselves say they're not? So it's a very...
Well, they're not going to let you get away with that.
Well, but...
Can I go out and sell bromomescaline and say, well, it's not a drug?
Well, here's the thing. If you're Coinbase and you want to avoid the fight, why not just trade Ether and Bitcoin are about half their volume, right? And they're not in dispute. But how do you deal with the other half as a business matter? Now, the big difference was the founder wasn't sued. So the guy who runs Coinbase wasn't sued by the SEC. And the Binance, the founder was.
Yeah, I noticed that. And you said the suits are different. That's right here. The SEC's lawsuit against Coinbase bore some notable differences from its lawsuit today against Binance. The SEC didn't name the American Coinbase chief executive, Brian Armstrong, as defendant or accuse the company of mishandling customer funds. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, one is a policy regulatory fight, and the other is a real fight to the death. That's the way I would describe it.
You didn't sue a CEO?
Mm-mm.
Let me back up. When you sue somebody in a court, if you're going to go after a company, okay, I worked at a law firm, we sued Exxon. You always go after everybody you can. Because if you don't, and it turns out that they are not just a patsy, not a fall guy, but in fact the real problem, and you didn't name what's called a necessary part of the lawsuit,
right?
Okay, you've waived your right to bring that lawsuit,
right?
You know, maybe through the statute of limitations expiring or whatever. You always name everybody. For the SEC not to name the CEO, it's just I fell on the floor when I read that. Like
well,
he did what?
Yeah, but let's go back. Look at the HSBC. You know, America, you know, the Department of Justice, by and large, leaves the executives untouched. That's their way of doing it, right?
Yeah.
This is a policy regulatory matter. You don't make that fight personal. So it doesn't surprise me that they didn't sue him. But it says that there's a very big difference on what they're up to with Binance than what they're up to with Coinbase. They're making it a business problem, not a personal fight.
I mean, he could still be subpoenaed, Brian Armstrong, the CEO.
Yeah.
But you didn't name him in a lawsuit? I just like.
Well, he's still got a world of hurt and trouble. So. But if you really want to mess up a company, you sue. The worst thing you can have as a CEO is a different attorney than the company attorney. So you got an attorney representing your company and an attorney representing you. And suddenly there are conflicts of interest between you as a CEO and you as an individual in the litigation. And then you're talking about, you know, you can really go crazy in those situations.
Yeah, I guess we're going to have to wait and see how these lawsuits get disposed of. Let's see how they get resolved.
Here's the thing. The war on crypto has just started. This is the beginning.
So just answer this. What are the stakes in the war on crypto? In Gensler's war on crypto, what's the one thing he wants more than all other things? What's the brass ring here?
He wants the same regulation as exists in the securities industry. He wants one regulatory framework for it all, securities or crypto.
Why does he want that?
He wants it because it's a speculative investment market and because whatever the central bank does, they want to have control. They want to control the space. They can't afford for too much innovation and leakage outside of the space.
They've already got on-ramps and off-ramps. In other words, to get into and out of crypto, you got to go through dollars. You got to go through banks. There's no other way.
Right.
You can't go to a little kiosk where a guy takes cash and gives you crypto. Mm-mm.
Right. But he doesn't want the kind of speculation going on. I mean, if you look at the investor harm that happened from 2020 until, you know, now, it's very significant. And if you look at the fraudulent schemes, it's a lot of little guys got hurt.
A lot of little guys got hurt. Yeah, that's true. It, in a lot of ways, it is like the stock market, except it's dark. So whatever crimes are committed in the stock market in terms of front running, multiplying by 10
right
in the crypto space, because there's no policeman.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But it's also, you know, it makes life much more complicated if you have a totally independent, separate regulatory structure for crypto than you do for securities.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah. Okay. Let's move on to an AI story. I love this next story. I've never seen this publication before. Vaccine impact. This story is great. This concerns the story that surfaced last week about an Air Force colonel talking about a rogue AI killing a human operator, but he was caught lying. It turns out he was lying. And the writer of the story says, today, the alternative media really is just as bad as mainstream media. It's full of fake news, and much of it is surrounding the fear-mongering concerning AI and how they are going to create transhumans and replace and eliminate human beings. One such story, Vaccine Impact says, that was widely published as news last week was the story of how a U.S. Air Force colonel was reporting that the military was training AI computers to carry out attacks against enemies, but then turned on its operator and killed him also during a simulation. Turns out that didn't happen, but the spin on it is a little bit different. He says the U.S. military themselves came out and reported it was fake news, although they didn't say that. Here's how the Air Force phrased it. An Air Force colonel who oversees AI testing used what he now says is a hypothetical to describe a military AI going rogue. So he was speaking hypothetically. The Air Force stated, it appears the colonel's comments were taken out of context and were meant to be anecdotal, which is just a polite way of saying he lied, according to Vaccine Impact. And he concludes here, Vaccine Impact, the writer of this story, concludes, globalists who are doing what they always do in this story, they're promoting a climate of fear so that they can then come in and rescue the day with their own solutions. Very interesting take on that story.
So Farrell wrote the funniest thing at Giza Death Star about this, about they did, they didn't, they did, they did, they did, they didn't. And honestly, I can't tell what happened, what went on. I can't tell what the progression of events are. You just...
Yeah.
Right.
You know it didn't happen. Okay.
We know that. I'm highly confident it didn't happen.
Yeah. The colonel right. himself fessed up. But the reason I picked that story and I like that conclusion is that the next story now makes sense. Okay.
Right.
The next story is from the BIS. And look at this. Project Leap proves the viability of quantum safe financial system. This story is pure PR now that you have that background.
Right.
Let's just scroll down. We had an experiment, says the BIS, and its success paves the way for the partners to build a complete chain of trust for central bank applications, acting as a blueprint for the financial system. Why do they need to do this? Well, because we got quantum computers, okay? Quantum computers are the risk here. Once they reach sufficient size and power, they'll be able to easily break the cryptographic encryption schemes currently used to ensure financial transactions and data. So in other words, you're doing all your business electronically, but quantum computers are there. Ooh, isn't that scary, children? But don't worry. The BIS is right here with a solution in the form of Project Leap. Aren't you glad?
Well, in theory, if what they say is true, that they can protect transactions and all the other systems can't, guess what happens? Giant sucking sound.
Yeah.
If it's true.
Yeah, again, it's hard to get money out of the banking system.
Yep. Well, here's the thing. They have sovereign immunity legally. You add the equivalent on the secrecy side with digital technology, you've got some real power. Now, I'm assuming they've got something like that now, but, you know, if the database can destroy the encryption in all other systems.
Yeah.
Then we've got, you know, and this is why if there is one reason to make sure that analog continues and is healthy and robust, here it is.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, now that you mentioned that, there's three ways of getting money out of the banking system. And you just mentioned the third way. It's just cash check at your bank.
Right.
Write a check for $100 cash and just get rid of the electronic money and convert it into paper money.
So we had a subscriber write in, I told you this week, saying I was checking out at Natural Grocers and I asked the cashier how many of their customers use cash. And they said about 50%.
Whoa.
Right.
Whoa, that's interesting.
Well, one way to using cash for budgeting purposes, you know, and groceries is a big part of the family budget. So using cash and envelope systems, it makes sense.
There's not a lot of trust in the system now, I must say. No.
There is no trust in the system now.
Yeah, I won't go into the conversation over her on the bus yesterday. You know, I ride my bike. I tend to use the bus system like a ski lift. Mm-hmm. I ride downhill and I take the bus uphill. And,
oh, well, that's smart.
Yeah, you kind of get some interesting chatter on the bus. And I got some yesterday. But anyway, let's just say that there's a lot more trust in Trump because he speaks the truth. And people know that they're trying to suppress the truth. That's why they hate Trump, because he's speaking the truth. That was the upshot from the discussion on the bus.
Really? Awesome. Did he tell you the truth about the injections?
I'm just saying generally. They didn't trust. They called him Santanus.
Anyway. I don't get the Trump thing. I don't get the Trump thing. I'll be back in the United States, so I fly back not this coming Sunday, but the following Sunday. So I'm curious to see.
Come to Raleigh. We'll take some bus rides. Okay.
Okay.
All right, let's move on to Farmageddon.
Okay.
This is a very interesting story. Dr. Yaden requests Dr. Malone, it's very important that you level with your large audience. Please tell them there wasn't a novel virus and the injections were carefully designed to hurt people. This is not, I don't know whose Interest of Justice is the name of the Substack, which I finally got to highlight by logging in. Oh, well. Dr. Yaden's telegram on June 6 says this: my plea to Dr. Robert Malone. I fear he and the inevitable David Martin are using their extensive platforms, inter alia, among other things, to reinforce the idea that there's been a novel and often lethal respiratory virus striding across the globe. It wasn't true, but they speak as though it is true. Yeah, no kidding. That is why I've paid such close attention to the top. But please don't shoot the messenger. Best wishes, Mike. And then he goes on. The bottom line here is twofold. One, there's no evidence of any kind of any pandemic. Two, therefore, there wasn't a novel respiratory virus either. It was all lies. There's copious evidence of planning for a pandemic going way back. It's all about authoritarian regimes and mass vaccination as objectives.
So the one thing I will say, it was interesting because someone put this out on the listserv, and one of the doctors who dealt a lot with using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin during the pandemic said, and it corroborated what I experienced and heard from subscribers, there were weird pockets of sickness happening, and they were weird, and people really were sick. Now, if you look at the numbers, it's no more than a year with a lot of annual flu. So right. Mike's right. And I don't think it was a pandemic. My question always was, is it low-grade biological warfare? Is it EMF rollout? Is it chemical warfare? What was causing these pockets? But whatever it wasn't like one sickness that was transmitted by viral spread. So Mike's right that there was no COVID-19 pandemic. And the question was...
That's why they had to go to cases, is the bodies weren't piling up enough to come remotely near a pandemic. And then suddenly they went to like, oh, well, we'll just count cases based on the cases.
Right, but there was weird stuff happening that was causing people to be sick in weird ways. Something was...
Okay. There's some interesting symptoms.
Right. And they were different in different places. Constantly we would hear from subscribers that there was heavy spraying and then these sicknesses would happen. But it was coming from...
You have to remember that the average American is a hypochondriac who's boring and they love to talk about their illnesses and how interesting they are. And that's... Once attention got focused on that, you were going to get a lot of weird stories. And we did.
Well, but the other thing is what doctors keep telling me is that the number one cause of sickness was fear.
Right.
As well as the stress from having your business shut down and lockdowns and all that kind of stuff. So media fear and economic stress were the cause of a lot of sickness.
Yeah, right. But there's no way to unpack that all and come out and conclude there's some novel illness. That's ridiculous.
Well, Matt Taibbi just came out. I don't know if you saw it. I just saw the article this morning saying they've now found patient number one or patient zero, who was one of the lab people handling the gain of function research. And I took a look at it and I said, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. I know what to say, but it's not nice. Okay. Let's go to pushback.
Okay. I'm ready. Pushback. Happy.
From the Defender. Irish farmers protest plans to cull livestock to meet climate targets. Look at this. Farmers in Ireland are protesting government proposals to cull livestock, including up to 200,000 cows. Well, so much for save the animals and save the whales. This is killing now. In an effort to meet national and European Union climate targets. According to Ireland's Independent, up to 65,000 dairy cows and 10% of the livestock herd would have to be removed from the national herd every year for 3 years at a cost of 200 million euros if the farming sector is to meet its climate targets.
You know, can I just point out that that's 75 million less than what J.P. Morgan Chase is paying to cause Jane Doe number one to go away?
Right. That's a great point.
Right.
It's a great point. And by the way, this information to round this out, these figures came from an Irish government document the Independent got, the publication that reported this got, following a Freedom of Information request. So they learned this, like, you're going to kill 200,000.
Right. And remember what Kennedy, Senator Kennedy said, if we do all of this stuff and the Chinese don't change their habits, it will have zero impact.
Yeah. Anyway.
How do you feel about that? Strikes me that they want to control the food supply.
Yeah. They just make up these numbers. It's completely made up.
Right.
Totally made up. Like the science has settled. The science has settled and icebergs are growing under global warming.
Yeah. We don't want you to have animal protein or fat.
But just be honest with you. Admit you want to control everything and you're making shit up. I mean, that's what you do.
Yep.
And now you're making shit up to kill a big portion of the food supply. Let's just be blunt.
Right.
You know, ridiculous whole thing. Okay, let's go back. Let's continue on pushback. I love this next one, too. And I wanted to highlight this. There's a lot of room up here, but this is from Pensions and Investments. This is not exactly like a rabble-rousing publication. BlackRock now paying for guards, home security for CEO Larry Fink. Oh, okay. Mr. Fink in 2020, his security guards and upgraded home security at his private residence has a price tag of $376,000 in 2022. This came from the firm's proxy statement. Okay. That's a lot of security, right?
Right.
Not so fast. The criticism of BlackRock comes from across the political spectrum. Last fall, a group of climate activists protested BlackRock's investment in fossil fuels at the company's New York headquarters, blocking escalators and reportedly strewing coal across the floor. So this is, I guess, a climate group is on the left side of the political spectrum. The company has also drawn the ire of Republicans who claim BlackRock's ESG investing is an overreach. It discriminates against certain energy industries like coal. And France, where people really know how to protest, anti-pension reform protesters stormed BlackRock's Paris headquarters with smoke bombs and flares. Yeah, that's more like it. Now let's go on. Look at this. How much round-the-clock residential security services cost, according to this expert, Kent Moyer? He says minimum cost for one executive could be anywhere from $500,000 to $3 million per year. So that $376,000 Larry Fink's expending, either he's not reporting it accurately or he's cutting corners on his security costs.
Right.
But he's got new security. That's the point of this.
So I can't, you know, I have to say that it is a compliment to our society that these guys have been safe so far.
Yeah, it really is.
If you look at the killing, you know, you can kill with the pen. And Larry Fink is someone who kills with the pen. He destroys businesses with a pen. He kills with a pen. He kills by facilitating monetary policy that destroys families. You know, I could go on and on, you know, because I can see very clearly what, you know, how many people and livelihoods and businesses Larry Fink and BlackRock have helped to kill. And at some point, you know, the general public is going to come to understand that. And when they do, I cannot imagine being Larry Fink or his family. And I wonder, what are these guys thinking?
I don't know. I wonder, it has to cross their minds, right?
You know something? You know, I used to deal with Larry on occasion, and I would say that Larry was, you know, he was not someone who had a lot of empathy for people, and he did not, you know, he didn't have a good feel for the crowd.
No, I know.
And
right.
He would.
I get it.
He's the kind of person who could go way too far responding to the simulation of the media and everything else and not realize the danger. Now, you would see there was a whole class of people in Washington who were very effective at lobbying and sort of working the system, and they would stay absolutely invisible. And the reason they would stay absolutely invisible is they had a long history in their mind. You know, they remember the French Revolution. They know how dangerous it is to be perceived as having great political power and swinging around a lot of money. And but you have this whole sort of new group that's come up with the tech bubble and their hubris, you know, and many of them are autistic. They're on the spectrum.
We saw the woman last week talking about, well, I called up my friend in Massachusetts. Are you going to let him have football?
Right. You know, they've been in a bubble, and when you're in a bubble, you don't hear the drumbeat. And you have a lot of people in this bubble, they don't hear the drumbeat. Now, they have a lot of confidence in the mind control. They have a lot of confidence in the sort of control and the media's ability to control. And if and when that really breaks down, they will be surprised.
Yeah. But I totally I agree with what you said about Larry Fink, and I find that believable. I did a video that had Larry Fink in it called Larry and Carson's Excellent Pandemic, and I lead off that video with a clip of Larry Fink talking about how markets, they don't like democracies, they like totalitarian governments. But the guy is just like, you know there's a camera that's on with the record button depressed. This is going on a national TV, Larry.
Here's the thing. They've gotten away, you know, from the time of President Kennedy's killing on, the hubris has grown and grown and grown because they keep getting away with it. And as long as their system of getting away with it works. Now, the problem is to take the next leap, you need that total financial repression. They can't, you know, the media and mind control will not take it 100% of the way. You need that financial transaction control.
Yeah. I tell you, you got to wonder, what's the over-under on the first beatdown on one of these people? And the other question is, have we already seen it? And it's just been marketed as another story. In other words, a member of the public gets fed up and just says, you know what, that's it for you.
Well, but here's the thing. It's not just physical. Remember, the day that the establishment in general starts to identify and shun you, your family, your wife, your kids. Yeah. I mean, imagine your kids going to school and coming home crying because they're being shunned because you're who you are.
But they're in bubble land. They all go to the same schools, the same elite schools. Never happened.
Right. But bubble land, one of our stories, you know, because I'm recording News Trends and Stories part one and part two this weekend with Dr. Farrell. You know, we're beginning to see the U.S. establishment, you know, it's breaking down because they're beginning to realize, wait a minute, this is killing the goose that laid the golden egg.
Yeah.
You know, you have a lot of insiders not only being kicked out, but looking at what's going on and saying, look, you know, you can't function as a society if you're not agreement capable and there's no law.
Yeah.
That's why the neocon strategy on the Ukraine and whether they're willing to go to a serious false flag is an important question mark. Can you take the lawlessness further? You know, can you take the financial repression all the way? And will that help you jump the curve?
They're going to push it until they get a beatdown. I'm telling you right now.
Right.
And I don't know what form the beatdown is going to take, but the beatdown on its way. It's on its way.
Right. And so we have to be prepared to navigate that.
Yeah. Okay, last story in pushback concerns the hazy orange smoke cloud that enveloped all of New York and really, to be blunt, came all the way down North Carolina. I rode my bike through it. It was bad. This is from Naomi Wolf, and I'm just going to show this headline. Trapped in surreal orange smoke in New York City, do we know what really happened? And I'm going to make a detour here.
because she eventually includes in here a video, and I'm going to come back to this video because she has something interesting in it. But I want to detour over to the World Economic Forum. Remember, they reported global risks in 2023. They said, and so they had a list. They had short-term risks of things that could happen. And you look at four of them are weather events. They're in green. Two,
right.
Four, six, and seven are all climate-related, okay? Keep that in mind when we watch this Naomi Wolf video here. Here's the video. And listen to what she says about the orange cloud.
Reports from InfoWars are that people in Canada, firefighters in Canada, tried to get in to fight the fires. They were prevented from doing it. And of course, Justin Trudeau, has called out the military and is telling people to stay indoors. So another lockdown, this one environmental.
You heard Naomi Wolf say it's an environmental lockdown.
Right.
That's what that was about, according to
InfoWars. I can't find one person in our network who thinks the fires are natural or who believe these orange clouds have anything necessarily to do with the fire because of the way they came up. So, you know, the reaction across the spectrum, which is so different than it would have been 5 years ago, is, okay, this is all unnatural and everything the government says is a lie.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. So the question is, well, what is this a pretext for? And I think you just heard it with Naomi Wolf saying it's a lockdown.
Right.
You know, it's Trudeau. I mean, he'd be all over it, you know?
Well, my other question is, what's going on in the sky that you can't see?
Yeah, but you'll never know that.
Right.
You know, I mean, we do know. We have some track record of Trudeau.
Right.
Now, this is the guy who steals your money out of your bank.
Right.
If you're on the wrong side of a protest,
right?
You know, you don't think he'll back a climate lockdown? Are you kidding me?
Right.
Of course he would. And the question is, was that orange cloud was it another beta test? You know, the beta test being, can we sucker American people into thinking this is a forest fire when in fact it's just some cloud we sprayed all over the place?
Right.
You know, I don't put anything past these people.
No.
And I think that if you're dismissive about stuff like, oh, that would never happen, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So with that cheery note, let's move on to charts, starting with coin and gold. And
yeah. So I wanted to take a look at how Coinbase had performed. So they came public during the April 2021, during the pandemic. And of course, got quite a run with when the crypto market was up, but they are down and down more. You know, I think they're down 12% total recently just on the SEC action.
That's minus 82% in change.
Right. So SEC not helping. So they're down 82% because they came out on the pump and now they went through the dump. Bitcoin is only down 55% during that same period. And then, of course, S&P... for this exact period was up 4.64%. It's up about 9 to 11% for the year. And then gold up more. When you showed that equity chart of best performance, you know, they didn't break gold and silver out of commodities. So gold, you know, would have been one of the good performers during that period if they had. Anyway, so
this is
So if you're Brian Armstrong, you know, you have plenty of stuff to deal with. Even though they didn't sue you, I'm sure you're glad you're not Brian Armstrong. It's a tough position to manage.
I thank my lucky stars I'm not rocking Brian Armstrong. Okay, let's keep it going. Gold's S&P, Bitcoin, here we go.
Yeah, so I wanted to take a look at a longer period. Just so you could see the whole Bitcoin. You know, I really believe the crypto pump was, among other things, a vaccine marketing plan. You know, you just kept everybody really busy. But this will show you how extraordinary the pump was. And, of course, it's, you know, going back to 2020, if you had started out in 2019, this goes back to the when they voted on going direct. You know, if you bought Bitcoin at the same time they voted on going direct, you're still up significantly and more than all the other, you know, things in the market. So TLT, the 20-year Treasury ETF, down 31%. you know, gold and S&P are up, but nowhere near as spectacular as Bitcoin.
But yeah, but look at the compression in this chart. I mean, S&P and TLT, right. They look neck and neck here.
Right.
They're not. S&P's up 50%. TLT's down over 30%.
Right.
The reason for the compression is
Bitcoin
got up as high as 550%.
Right. Well, that was an amazing pump. That was an amazing pump. And I think that's why the idea that some of those whale deposits were helping make that pump go is a legitimate question.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, let's keep it going with FinViz.
Natural gas. That's a hell of a price to make your 27-year deal.
Yeah, that's a big one. VIX stays at the bottom of this one. There's not a lot of... There's 1 year and a 3 year we'll have. There's not a lot of movement between the two. There's a little bit, but not much.
Right. I still can't get over the VIX.
That's our 1 year and a 3 month. Yeah, the VIX, but it's in the basement at both the times.
Well, remember, thanks to those 5 to 10 stocks, you know, as a technical matter, the S&P is now in bull territory. We're back in a bull.
Yeah. The only one that I could really see moving is Oats is up in the 3 month.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you look in the year, Oats is way down. But I don't know, my tarot cards on Oats aren't telling me anything.
Right. You know? I still say that this says that the Fed strategy of tempering, you know, commodity prices with interest rates is working.
I would agree with that.
Right.
I think that's exactly right.
But I also think the NASDAQ is up because they're pouring money through the back door into the smart grid. It's got nothing, and government contracts, and it's got nothing to do with economics.
Yeah, right. Okay. And then our last chart here.
Yeah, so I just wanted to look at the safety trade. And basically, here's the, so the title is wrong. This is the NASDAQ QQQ versus the S&P. And so what we're seeing is, you know, all the strength is in the tech stocks. That's our point. So QQQ is the NASDAQ ETF. So S&P up 14% for the year, but QQQ up 37%. That's where the strength is.
They're very linear.
Yep.
Very linear increases.
Yep.
You know, but we'll see. I mean, you look at that chart and you can't even see, like, tell me where the bank crisis was, the bank failures.
I mean, if we put some of the bank ETFs, we'd see it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We'd see it. Just look at March. Okay. See where it dips down in March.
We shall see in March.
Right.
What happens. But you can't see it in that chart. It's not that noticeable.
Right.
Anyway. Okay. You ready for Hero previous wrap-ups and connections?
Yeah. So Hero is quite a story. It's Dr. Arne Burkhardt. So our weekly interview is from the solution series, How to Become a Local Activist with Patrick Wood. Yeah. And we'll also be publishing the next one, the next in the series from the Spiritual Science Academy. And of course, Patrick, everybody's used to hearing him talk about technocracy and the sovereign immunity of the BIS, but he also does a tremendous amount with transparency and how to be effective at the local area. You know, he used to be in the municipal bond business, so he really understands places. Anyway, a super, super guy.
Okay. Now here you go.
Dr. Arne Burkhardt was a German pathologist. He died on May 30th, and he is not a household name, John, but this is a man who has had such an extraordinary impact. You had Dr. Bakhti, Dr. Palmer, a lot of great doctors and scientists saying how dangerous mRNA technology was, but you needed autopsies and a pathologist to absolutely put meat on the bone and back them up and prove that they were absolutely right. Burkhardt had just retired when he'd sold his lab equipment when the family started coming to him. He's a very famous and accomplished pathologist in Germany in his field. And so the family started coming to him because they were getting basically coroner reports that were lies. And he came out of retirement. I don't know how he scrounged up new lab equipment. He did over 80 autopsies that basically took all these doctors and scientists warning about mRNA technology, and he put them on solid ground. And from then on, you know, it was unbelievable because their confidence was total. They could bet the ranch. They had the science and they had the facts. And he gave them that. And I, you know, I've always believed he had become, because if you look at the amount of money that's betting on mRNA technology, you've got big, big investments. And he was very dangerous for them. Very dangerous.
Yeah. So and now he's dead.
And now he's dead. And
but
it's,
so he's the guy who takes somebody like Bhakti and says it's not just an allegation. It's an allegation. It's now substantive. It's now backed by clinical fact.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, there was so much effort to stop or sort of engineer the autopsies. And for a pathologist of his eminence to come out and do what he did at personal expense and risk, you know, he just, and when you saw what he did, it took your breath away. He was so courageous. For a man to have such skill and experience and judgment, he had incredible practical common sense kind of judgment and could communicate very effectively with people who were very expert, but also with lay people. There's a new interview, the last interview he did before he died is coming out. I've seen portions of it. It's incredible. And for somebody to have that much experience and judgment and talent to take this issue, which impacts billions, and have that kind of impact just from the power of his mind and work, you know, this was a truly great person and very inspiring. So.
And we covered this on Money and Markets with the autopsies sort of moving around and the suppression effort against autopsies. Remember, they would move into hospitals conducting their own autopsy.
Right.
They get somebody dead. Like, oh, everything's fine. Nothing to see here. Move along. Right. We've done our autopsy. You don't need an external guy to do an autopsy at all.
And it was funny because, and you see this in his last interview, Burkhardt didn't expect to find what he found because he knew when he found it, this is a mass atrocity. He documented and proved.
So did I hear that correctly? In his last interview, he expressed surprise at what he found.
No, he expressed that he was surprised when he first found it. He explained that he did not expect to find what he found.
Right. And that's a big story.
When he found it, it never occurred to him to back off because he understood the power and the ramifications of what he was looking at, because he was looking at a genocide, an intentional genocide that was done intentionally, and it was being suppressed, and he knew it, and he documented it, and he understood the power of what he was doing and the danger, but there was no hubris, there was no arrogance, there was no, it was just like, well, I'm a human, this is what I'm called to do, I must do this.
Wow, but before he got out and was able to tell that story, very much. I went in thinking one thing and I found something else. I was totally surprised. Before he's able to tell that story, he dies.
Well, no, because I mean, we all knew that. And he had said all of this and explained all of this to the, you know, in the Doctors for COVID symposium or Doctors for COVID Ethics symposium and on many interviews and speeches. So he'd done that within a smaller group of people. He had just covered that.
But not in an interview.
No, he'd done it in an interview. But this interview was, I think, is special because it goes into the human element in great detail in a way that I don't think he's done before. And so, you know, it's really designed for the lay audience to understand the power and importance of what he did. Now, you know, I think the problem was that, you know, Sutrid winning his case really put mRNA technology on the chopping block. And if you look at what Sutrid and Arne and all these people were going to do next, you know, there's a book coming out on mRNA technology. And I think the mRNA investors are in real trouble. How are they going to smother millions of deaths?
That's a good question.
Because this is not just the COVID-19 injections. This is all mRNA injections. all mRNA technology. And remember, they're putting it in your cattle, they're putting it in your pork, they're putting it in your food. And this is across the food spectrum and across the pharmaceutical spectrum. And the investors, if you listen to the investment community, they think they're going to make hundreds of billions of dollars on this.
That's what they're focused on for
sure.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a big thing.
Yep. You want to touch on collateral markets, the book review?
Oh, so I sent you a book review I did. I published this last year in October, and it's a book by a deputy director at the IMF on the collateral markets. Ever since the financial crisis, there is a real shortage of collateral. And this came up because I was looking at the whale deposits. So you did a video that you published a week ago. It's up at your Best Evidence channel on YouTube. It's about the whale deposits and their involvement in the banking crisis. And it's wonderful because the whale deposits are the anomaly that tell you the official story is completely bunk. And then you start digging in and you start getting the real story. Anyway, but, you know, I was looking at, okay, why would anybody leave $1 billion deposit in an individual's account or manufacture that? You know, the logical reason is to create collateral. And the question is, collateral for what? There are many possibilities. So I sent you that because I was thinking about collateral and the fact that there's a shortage in the collateral market. And what's so funny about this book is it goes around and around. It's the ultimate pretzel talk. It makes this week's Financial Times article look totally coherent. But essentially, the one thing he can never say is there's a shortage in the collateral market. The multiplier has shrunk since the financial crisis because there's so much collateral fraud, nobody trusts anybody else.
Yeah.
But, you know, $1 billion cash deposit sitting at Silicon Valley Bank, you can trust that, right? It's simple. It's clear.
You could put it in a treasury, too. That's collateral. It's the most liquid market in the world.
But if I'm the Fed and I wanted to manufacture lots of collateral fast, creating whale deposits is a way to do it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. My video, by the way, is also up at BitChute, Odyssey, and Rumble as well.
Good.
Not just YouTube.
And Soleri in the News. You can find it.
I have it set up. So I've got BitChute and Odyssey set up so that whatever I put on YouTube, it's mirrored.
Right.
I just don't trust any of these platforms. So I'll tell you that. I don't trust any.
Well, that's
any
why
of them.
We have our own video server.
Yeah.
And it doesn't perform as well because obviously they have more servers around the world. But I want to make sure, you know, we had hundreds of videos on Vimeo and then bam, they took us down, no notice. And we knew YouTube would do it. We hadn't expected Vimeo. I can't tell you how much work it took. And that's what I said.
They're all the same. I can look at the numbers. Right. I've dealt with all of these platforms. In Substack, all of them. They're all the same. They're all part and parcel of the same criminal enterprise running all of this.
I agree.
Numbers are completely bogus, and they will yank the rug out. So the thing to do is just to diversify. It's your only hope.
Right.
And keep, preserve
a portion analog.
Damn right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I want to start moving some videos onto DVD. That's a story for another day.
Yep. Okay. Okay. Anything else on the Soleri list?
No, that's it. There was one thing, spiritual science, but I take it that's coming next week.
No, it's coming this week, but we don't have the link for it yet, but it'll be up by the end of the week. Okay.
Okay. Well, and with that, that's it.
Yeah. No, I do want to say that I will be leaving for the United States on June 25th. I'll be there till July 30th. I'll be in Tennessee. I have Freedom Fest. We'll put that out in the update this week. We have Freedom Fest in Tennessee in the Knoxville area on July 18th. And I'll be doing an event with Gary Humble, Tennessee Stands, in Murfreesboro on July 25th. You can find more about that on the events portion of the website. So here I come.
The one thing I want to say before we conclude is that I put out a request for donations in my last video, and Soleri subscribers contributed, and your thank you notes are on the way. So if you haven't gotten them, my mom would beat me silly if she knew I didn't send out thank you notes. So they're coming. Anyway,
so I have to tell you, I have to brag. We have the best subscribers on the planet. because they send intelligence, they send money, they send prayers, they send whatever. And, you know, every time we have a dinner together at Soleri, somebody at the end of the meal says, thank you, Soleri Report subscribers.
Yeah, well, thank you, Soleri Report subscribers, for helping me. I appreciate it. It's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, well, we appreciate them and we appreciate you, John. So you have a great week. We have one more Money in Markets this month, so I will see you next week.
Okay. See you next week, Catherine.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report. We'll talk next week.